These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
On today's program, we're talking about birth. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm in the studio today with professionals who help mothers bring their children into our world. This hour, we'll hear from one mom who labors at work as a labor and delivery nurse at Providence Hospital, and we'll hear the intimate thoughts of brand new parents as they coo over their five-day-old daughter. We'll talk to one local psychiatrist who wants to improve birth and the time that comes just before and after it, all to help prevent the risk of child maltreatment. It's a new year, and the conversation is about birth on Kids These Days. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy, your host. All of us at Kids These Days hope you had a wonderful holiday season and that you're enjoying the new year. I want to remind you that you can be a part of this conversation. Join us online anytime at kidsthesedays.org or send us a message right now. That's mail@kidsthesedays.org. Today, I'm in the studio with birthing experts from our region, Jessica Sawyer from Matsu Midwifery and Dr. D. Glenn Elrod of Sleeping Lady Women's Healthcare in Wasilla are here today. And also with us is Lisa Weston from the Alaska Native Medical Center and South Central Foundation. We'll be discussing birth and all the ways to go about it. Full introductions and that conversation is coming up shortly. But first, let's set the stage. Today, we'll be talking a lot about pregnancy and birth and some of the ideas that go along with prenatal care and ways of delivery. But ultimately, new parents end up at home with a brand new person to take care of. Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez recently attended the birth of her very own niece, Julia Paz. She asked her sister Jamie and Julia's new dad, Matt, to share their thoughts after their first 5 days of parenthood.
This is Julia Paz Reed, and she was 6 pounds 15 ounces at birth and 19 and a half inches long, and we think she's perfect. She has dark hair and a beautiful little round head. She's not all coney.
She has frog legs, and they're very difficult to get into pajama bottoms. Occasionally, you find 2 feet in one, or two of her feet in one of the legs of the pajamas.
So everyone says that they're exhausted, and it's magical. What else is it?
It's frustrating because you want to fix everything and find an answer and make her happy. You don't know how to do all that.
Did you expect to feel that way when you were pregnant?
No, it seemed a little simpler. It seems like this little less than 7 pound baby should be fairly simple. You know, how hard can it be? They're just a little tiny person and they eat and sleep and poop. If you can figure out the magic key, then it should be easy, but it's not.
So you've been parents for 5 days. Does it feel like longer or shorter than that?
It feels like one really, really long day so far, since there's not really a designated sleeping time.
I'm always the one who drifts off to sleep and says, "I'm sorry, Jamie." I kind of feel bad about that. I wish I could do as much to console Julia, but I'm ill-equipped, I think, biologically speaking, anyhow, so...
So what do you feel right now when she's so little? What do you feel like your role as a father, as Julia's father, is?
She wants and needs so much right now. I mean, that's pretty much what she does. She wants to sleep and she wants food. And I think one of my main jobs is supporting Jamie. But I also, I feel very protective of her. I remember when she went to go get her vaccinations and I couldn't not touch her while that was happening, and I felt like a little bit of the pain that she's going through when it's just a little needle in her arm, but it's maybe taking some of the pain for her, but that may be a little philosophical.
Jamie, have you ever had this much lack of sleep in your life?
No. I love sleeping. I think we both did. We were kind of prepared to say goodbye for a little while. But, I mean, I figure it'll even out a little bit, but that, again, might be naive. We, I think, keep discovering how naive we are every time we hit a new milestone.
Is it weird, Jamie, to breastfeed in front of all these people? What are your thoughts about that?
I was never a naked person until I gave birth 5 days ago. And now I'm just whipping my boobs out all over the place, and it's not even embarrassing in the slightest. It's just function. And, you know, I haven't done it in public, but around a whole slew of family members so far. And it seems like it should feel weird, but it doesn't feel weird at all. It just feels like I'm feeding my little girl.
Matt, what went through your head when you first brought her home?
The one thing about bringing her home is I'm terrified of damaging her. When did it really hit me? The first night when neither of us slept very much. When you're in the trenches, trying to get her to sleep or trying to get somebody to sleep, and you put her on your chest, you do anything just to make her more comfortable. And so kind of breaking all the rules. That's when you feel like, you know, this is very real.
Jamie, do you feel like that too? Like you have to just kind of come up with your own rules? And is there any kind of like guilt associated with, oh, I'm not doing exactly what they told me I should do?
I think I'm so hormonal at this point that a lot of our decisions are based on what's not going to make me cry. And it just made me so sad to see this little tiny person in this big bassinet, even though, you know, it's snugged up right next to our bed and, you know, she'd be less than an arm's reach away. But it made me tear up every time I put her in there. So she started sleeping on my chest or on Matt's chest, and we've managed to put her in the bassinet probably a total of about 5 hours at this point. But there's certainly that element of you don't want to disappoint your family or, you know, these expectations that you feel are out there for being a good parent and taking good care of your child and making sure she has the best. And I don't know, there's a lot of stress associated with that too. But at some point, I think you're just going to make your own decision for whatever is going to make for a peaceful and good life for all of you.
I always feel like Jamie's being too hard on herself while, you know, in the middle of the night when the baby's kind of fussing or whatnot. But it's hard to say that, especially when I'm the one sleeping more and I'm the one who's kind of playing the supporting role. I'm not the first person that Julia needs when she's uncomfortable.
What do you expect the rest of like this first year to be like?
I'm excited for the days when she starts smiling in reaction to us and, you know, starts giggling. And right now it feels a little bit like we're surviving. You know, of course we're thrilled and we're excited, and everything she does is cute and unique and funny. And
oh, a cough.
Those were the voices of Jamie and Matt, brand new parents of little Julia Paz. That piece was put together by Julia's proud new auntie, Tia Sarah Gonzalez, our KTD producer. This is Kids These Days, and I'm in the studio today with guests to talk about birth and birthing and all that goes along with it. I'm Shanna Sheehy. So let me introduce our panel today. Lisa Weston is a certified nurse midwife employed by South Central Foundation and practicing at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. She's been there for 12 years. Thanks a lot for being here today, Lisa.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Jessica Sawyer is a certified direct entry midwife and a certified professional midwife practicing at Matsu Midwifery in Wasilla. She's practiced there since 2002, and she attends births both at the birthing center and also in homes. Thank you for being here, Jessica.
Thank you.
And Dr. D. Glenn Elrod is on the phone. He has an OBGYN practice called Sleeping Lady Women's Healthcare in Wasilla. Dr. Elrod spent 6 years in the United States Air Force, and he's been in private practice now for 3 years here in the state. And today you're joining us from Chicago. Is that right, Dr. Elrod?
That is. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Well, let's talk a little bit about the piece that we just heard. We heard two proud parents of a five-year-old baby saying a lot of things about the birth experience, a lot of things about the experience of being a new parent. Let me ask Jessica, I'll start with you. How close would you say this experience that they shared might be to other new parents that you encounter in your practice?
I think it's pretty typical. A lot of the difficulties that they come up with are pretty typical ones, definitely sleep deprivation. What struck me as I was listening was just, you know, even though it's a pretty typical story, there are unique details in there. And I'm just, you know, reminded again of how each family, each new baby, and each set of parents are a unique combination, a unique family. And I'm really grateful to be able to work in an environment where we're able to kind of treat each family as an individual. We don't have a cookie cutter kind of, you know, idea about prenatal care or about birth, and we're able to tailor our care to what's appropriate and what's comfortable for each family and for each mother. Just like Jamie was saying, she makes decisions by what won't make her cry.
I love that
part. I think
part.
We're really sensitive to mom's intuition and what they're comfortable with, and able to give pretty individualized care. So that's real satisfying.
Can we talk about natural childbirth? And I'd like to define what natural childbirth is. And part of the reason why I ask this question is because, you know, sometimes people say, like, what is unnatural childbirth, if there's such a thing as natural childbirth, for example? Lisa, maybe you can start.
Well, my whole definition of natural childbirth would be a low-risk patient who does not want any sort of interventions during her pregnancy, and no interventions to induce her labor or to make her go into labor before she's ready or before her body is ready to, and then having no interventions during the actual labor experience, nothing to speed up the experience, such as Pitocin to augment her labor, to make the contractions stronger, no artificial methods of pain management or pain relief, such as IV medication or epidurals or things of that nature. A lot of women start out, especially first-time moms, starting out saying, that's what I want. I'm really committed to having a natural pregnancy, a natural labor, and a natural birth experience. But having never gone through that before, sometimes those opinions change and those desires change. And then sometimes just the act of things that happen during labor increase the risks of prolonging, or they increase the act of pregnancy or going through pregnancy. There are some risks that come along that that change those desires, and medically change the indication to a less than natural childbirth experience.
I wonder if maybe, Dr. Elrod, you know the answer to this question. If you don't, that's fine. But what are women doing in terms of seeking their healthcare during pregnancy? Are more women looking to midwifery organizations, or are more women kind of going the obstetrician route?
Well, I think in the state of Alaska, it's certainly more prevalent to seek midwifery care.
It is more prevalent to seek midwifery care. And might you know, I mean, is there a sense of why that might be in our state?
I know that I was looking at some statistics, and in Alaska, the out of hospital births are at least 10 times what they are in the nation. In the Mat-Su Valley, the number of women who are seeking midwifery care is about 25% of the population, which is like 100 times the national average. So there definitely is something unique about Alaska as far as women wanting to do birth in a less medical way. I think from my experience, I have seen that women in Alaska tend to be really independent and self-sufficient and have a real can-do attitude. They expect that their pregnancy is going to go normally, that they're going to remain healthy. They expect that they will be up to the challenge of birth. And so with that positive mindset, a lot of them are very successful in having a completely natural pregnancy and birth. And I think another reason that midwifery is probably more prevalent and more popular in Alaska is just that over the history of the state, having lots of rural communities spread out, midwifery was necessary, definitely here for longer than it was probably in most of the rest of the country. So there still is some tradition of midwifery, maybe not that we can, you know, remember back to, but in the state it has been pretty much a constant presence, whereas in most of the country it kind of died away as the medical taking over of birth happened during the Industrial Revolution. So Alaska's kind of stayed a little closer to the roots of the village midwife, and I think that has allowed midwifery to kind of come back here faster than in most of the rest of the country.
Well, that's an interesting perspective for sure. So we're talking about the roots of the village midwife. We're talking about even before the time of obstetrics, right, mm-hmm. as a field of medicine.
Yes.
And this is, you know, historically, there were midwives or women who were skilled at delivering babies in villages and in small communities who would assist in mm-hmm. a woman who was giving birth. And so the word midwife actually comes from that sort of more ancient tradition, isn't that right?
Yes.
It does have an old sound to it. Mm-hmm. But then it seems like there's been a renaissance of midwifery. Is that the case?
I think so, yeah. In the country, birth has become so medical, and looking at the neonatal mortality statistics of our country is pretty abysmal. We spend the most money, and our babies are dying more than a lot of countries with less technology and who spend less money in their pregnancy and OB care. Mm-hmm. So definitely people are seeing that there need to be some changes made, although a lot of the technologies that we're using can definitely be life-saving and they have their place. When they're overused, they're actually causing complications and causing problems that if they were used more sparingly, I think we could avoid. So there has been a big, I guess, sort of consumer movement to get back to the basics and to try and, you know, be educated about which technologies are helpful and when they're helpful. And so I think that just the educated consumer is making a big difference in our country.
And when you say...
I think that's the big point, though. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I think that's the big point is that we need to make sure that our moms are as educated as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think that too often we see women who go through their prenatal care that don't get education about what their options are, and don't understand that an induction, although it may sound appealing because it finishes the pregnancy sooner and allows you to time when you're going to have your baby, is not the right option for most women.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Elrod, are you know, sometimes there are patients who are saying, I want these things, I want natural childbirth, epidurals, induction, C-section, and so forth. Are you speaking from your own practice? Do you have women coming to you and asking specifically for those interventions?
Yes. We do, and it's a good opportunity to try to sit down and educate them as to what the risks are of each of those choices, and what risk it has for the mom and also what risk it has for the baby,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully allow them to make the best choices that they can for themselves and also for their family.
So let's do some of that now. This is an opportunity to get some of that information out there to listeners. You know, what are some of these things that women can have in terms of intervention, and when should they have those things come into the birthing experience?
Well, I can give you that information. An epidural is a method of anesthesia that is performed in a hospital setting only. It's medication that's injected into the space around the spinal cord that is kind of like a continuous infusion of numbing medicine that makes women essentially numb from right below their breast to right at the thigh juncture. So the pain from contractions or the discomfort from contractions is totally alleviated. That also forces the mom to be in the bed for the duration of her labor. She's not able to feel the need to empty her bladder, so a catheter is placed in her bladder, and she can't move, essentially. So when she's fully dilated and it's time to have a baby, sometimes she is unable to even feel the urge to push or the urge to have her baby, and needs a lot of assistance with that.
And so when might an epidural be the right thing for a woman in labor?
I think I can answer that question really well, because most of the clients that I work with never need an epidural, so I can see really clearly when it is very helpful. There are two situations I can think of that it would really be appropriate. One is for a mom who is completely exhausted and who's needing some rest, whose contractions are coming every 3 minutes and they're strong, but they're not really accomplishing very much because she's exhausted and needs a little bit more oomph to finish the labor. Usually that would be a first-time mom whose labors tend to be a little longer. And so if she's kind of stopped making progress in the labor and is just needing some rest, an epidural would really be a wise choice. It would allow her to probably sleep for a couple of hours, let her body regain some energy, and then likely the contractions will get stronger after she's been rested, and the labor can probably resume and be productive at that point. And the second case I can think of is a mom whose baby may be malpositioned, and she's very tense and tight, and probably her resting muscle tone is keeping the baby from rotating to a more favorable position. And so just an epidural to help her relax and rest and allow her some time of resting and some time to allow her baby to hopefully get into a better position to make the birth progress and a little easier than it would be with a malpositioned baby. So I've seen some cases where a baby who's coming down backwards, a posterior presentation, just with an epidural and some time will flip over to a correct presentation and be born without any further complications.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Elrod, you mentioned induction. Can you describe what an induction is and then when it might be an appropriate time to do that?
Well, induction of labor is when you use medications such as Pitocin to start contractions. And they're started with the idea that you're going to deliver a baby at the end of the induction. Inductions are useful for medical conditions, high blood pressure, preeclampsia that is also associated with high blood pressure, gestational diabetes, things where there are medical problems with the pregnancy where it would be beneficial for the baby to be delivered. What we've talked about as options is that women and sometimes obstetricians, unfortunately, use inductions of labor to basically stop the pregnancy and say, okay, you've made it to your due date. You don't need to go any further. Now it's time to have a baby. Unfortunately, inductions carry with them some bit of risk, both risk of needing more interventions, such as epidurals, but also increase the risk of C-sections and complications from that.
From a perspective of being a medical doctor, if a woman does think that having an elective C-section is what she wants, what do doctors say when a patient comes to them and says that that's what they want?
Well, that's a tough question. I think my practice has changed really over time. Initially, I thought that, you know, there's really no reason for women to elect to have C-section. I went through a period where I thought, you know what, maybe we could allow women to make the choice because ultimately it is their body. But now in my practice, I really try to steer them away from that because we know that C-sections are major abdominal surgery. They carry risk just like any other surgery carries. It puts them at risk for pregnancy complications in the future if they were to have future babies. So we really spend a lot of time talking about not only the risk to the mom because of the fact that it's big surgery, but we also talk to them about risk to the baby because we know that babies who are born by C-section have a tougher time initially and statistically spend more time in the nursery and really have a rougher way to go. With labor, without labor, babies born by C-section still are more challenging to take care of.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe now it's a good time to sort of throw some numbers out there that I collected when I was researching for this program. So C-section rates in the United States in the 1960s were in the 4% range. 4% of births were resulted in C-section or done by C-section. And the numbers that are most recent for the nation come from 2007, and the rate was 32% of deliveries are done by C-section. So we're talking about a third, almost nearly a third of deliveries are done by C-section. The World Health Organization has made a recommendation for what they think would be, you know, a sort of more appropriate rate or percentage, and they say 15% is maybe what's medically necessary as a guess. what's going on? What's going on here? Why is it the case? I should also say that Alaska has a lower rate than that. The 2007 numbers were, it was 22.6% of women had a C-section, and the numbers for 2008 is 26.1. So it's gone up a little bit in that particular year spread. But what is going on? Why? I want to know why. Why are so many women having C-section?
Why have we gotten to that point?
Yeah, Dr. Elrod,
well,
why?
So I jotted down a couple of things that came to mind. Fetal monitoring, or being able to monitor the baby's heart rate, really kicked in about the time where the C-section rate was 4%. And we thought initially that monitoring babies' heart rates were going to really improve our ability to have good outcomes with babies. Unfortunately, I think what it did was increase the number of C-sections we did, because we saw things that we didn't like. And we did more C-sections, or we still do more C-sections, because of what we think is distress in babies. And so that's a part of it. I think, unfortunately, part of why C-sections have gone up is because of fear of malpractice in obstetrics, because we know that the malpractice rates for obstetricians are incredibly high. The lawsuits from obstetric injuries are particularly high. And so, you know, we feel like if we make an intervention sooner, we may not run that risk of malpractice. So mm-hmm. there's another risk for C-section. Things that have been lost in our practice these days, the delivery of breech babies, babies that are coming with their butts first instead of their heads first, that's a skill that's essentially been lost. Whereas, you know, 40, 50 years ago, it was fairly routine to deliver babies who were breech as a vaginal delivery mm-hmm. rather than a C-section.
And so, and it's just
more
a slight...
recently.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, like, delivering a breech baby is just a slightly different way of doing a delivery. So that ability's been lost, is what you're saying.
That ability's been lost. It's not taught anymore. There have been some articles that have shed some doubt as to whether it should be done or not. But regardless, it's a skill that's not being done. And now babies who are breech are almost universally born by cesarean section. And then lastly, women who have had previous C-sections can attempt to have a vaginal delivery in most cases, but that ability has been limited by obstetricians and by hospitals, so the rate of VBAC is substantially less than it could be. And so I think all of those reasons play a role in why our C-section rate is 30% now versus, you're right, probably what it should be, somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20%.
Hmm. Wow. And we should say VBAC is vaginal birth after...
Cesarean.
Right. Okay. You're listening to Kids These Days, and today the conversation is about birth. You can find us anytime at kidsthesedays.org, and you can connect with us through social media there and share what you learn on this program with your friends and your family. Today, I'm in the studio with Dr. D. Glenn Elrod, Lisa Weston, and Jessica Sawyer, and Dr. Elrod is joining us by phone from Chicago. We'll take a quick break from this show, the first program of 2011, and afterwards we'll go to work with a labor and delivery nurse and hear one local psychiatrist's ideas about the birth experience and prenatal and newborn care. That and more coming up in a minute. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Stay with us.
She's got a baby inside and holds her belly tight all through the night, just so she knows she's sleeping so safely to keep her growing. And oh, when she'll open her eyes, there'll be no surprise that she'll grow to be so beautifully just like her mother that's carrying. Oh, Capri, she's beauty. Baby inside, she's love.
Life begins at birth and ends at death. And whether or not a child or a family is ready for a loss, many struggle to find their way through it.
We wonder to kids these days, what does grief look like in a child? And what resources are there for kids and for families who are living the process? I'm Shanna Sheehy, and we're talking about bereavement next time on the program. Members of the Forget Me Not Grief program talk with me in the studio. Also, wise words from a local pastor who counsels families, and commentary from one young adult who remembers her mother and how it felt to be a teenager in grief. That and more next time on Kids These Days. Join us right here on KSKA, Tuesday at 2 and again at 7 p.m. We're back. You're listening to Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Today's conversation is about birth. I'm joined in the studio with guests Jessica Sawyer and Lisa Weston, and Dr. D. Glenn Elrod is on the phone this hour. But first, before we get back to our conversation, there's this. Many women giving birth spend more time with their labor and delivery nurses than with their doctor in the hospital. Hilke Bold has worked as an L&D nurse at Providence Hospital on and off since 1999. She loves her job, and recently she spent some time with KTD contributor Jessica Cochran explaining what it's all about.
We start the shift, it's about 7. We go in, we have a report, and that is an important part of the day because we're just getting a scoop on what's going on and who's there and where we're going to be assigned and things like that. And then the next part of the day after report is really getting to know your patient, and that's a crucial part of the day because you need to establish a relationship with your patient and find out really what their goals are and what their fears are and where they're at, you know, physiologically, what point in labor they're at, and sort of go from there. Basically, it's just taking care of the family and the woman in labor and making sure she has what she needs and making sure that the baby is doing okay. So that monitoring, obviously charting is a big part of the nurse's day, you know, and then being sort of the liaison between the patient and the practitioner, so the midwife or doctor, and the charge nurse, and sort of kind of keeping everybody informed about how things are progressing. My ideal day is when I come in and I have a family who's at some point in the beginning of her labor and things go through. We're there for 12 hours, so fairly often we're able to work with a family most of the shift and have them deliver at some point, and that's really wonderful because it's just neat to be able to be there for the delivery after being with them through the whole process. Most everything is geared toward delivery, so you know, regular vaginal deliveries, we're right there, and it's kind of neat because we get to be right there through sort of the long haul. We're there right with the woman during pushing and getting ready for delivery, and then making sure the team is there for delivery, making sure the doctor or midwife is there. You know, after delivery, they spend a couple hours in labor and delivery where we're taking care of the baby and doing the bath and all the initial assessments and helping the mom up to the bathroom and shower and helping with breastfeeding and just sort of being there to sort of facilitate bonding and being there for whatever the particular situation warrants. And then... take them over to the mother-baby unit and then find out what the next assignment is. Something is lost, something is found. I definitely think that if a woman has a positive birth experience, they're more confident in their breastfeeding and care for the baby and confidence in, yes, my body is doing what it's supposed to do. And it doesn't always work out that way. And then I think there's a need for a lot of extra reassurance and support and things. But if a birth experience goes in a positive way, whether there's hurdles or whether it's just smooth sailing, if it's a positive birth experience, I think it goes a long way for a good start to being a parent.
listen to you, and I want some more.
Dr. Elrod, I learned, I'm not sure if this was while you were in the Air Force, but I believe you've practiced obstetrics in places other than the United States. Is that the case?
It is. In the Air Force, I practiced at an Air Force base in England and got to work with some of the English midwives.
How could you compare that experience of delivering babies in England versus, you know, how it may be when you're home in the U.S.?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't deliver babies in England, but just learned from some of their practices. And I think the biggest practice, and listening to Lisa talk, really reminds me of what my practice is now. But one of the biggest things is letting moms eat while they're in labor.
Oh.
It seems kind of silly to think that we can allow moms to have a 24-hour labor without ever giving them anything to eat. But yet that's the standard for hospital births in the United States.
Why is that, doctor?
Mostly, I think, because of risk of needing a general anesthesia, so basically going off to sleep for an emergency delivery of the baby by C-section. So we've gotten ourselves into thinking that we need to prepare for the worst-case scenario. It's a scenario that very rarely ever happens. What I've noticed is my moms are so much happier with the fact that they get to eat. And most of them will regulate what it is that they eat. I've seen some eat 3 or 4 chef salads during their labor and been perfectly happy. I've seen some that don't want to eat anything, but they know that it's their choice. If they want to eat, they can.
Let me ask you all three. I was reading this book by Randy Hutter, Epstein called Get Me Out. It's a history of childbirth in the United States. We'll link to this and to some other resources that we talked about today at kidsthesedays.org. And there's a whole chapter in there about free birthing. Free birthing is where a woman would choose to go through her entire pregnancy and then also deliver her baby at home without any midwife or obstetrical help. Maybe I can guess, since you all are medical professionals, I might guess what your opinion would be about this, but I'd like to know what you guys think about the idea of free birthing, and is it happening in Alaska to anyone's knowledge? Dr. Elrod, let me start with you.
Oh, goodness. To me, it sounds dangerous. It probably is dangerous most of the time, and I'm not certain whether it's happening in Alaska. I'm sure it is. I've talked to some of the professionals that speak nationally. Ina McGaskin, I was just with in Japan for a conference, and we had a discussion about free birthing. And her feeling is, and I think it's probably true, is that a lot of this stems from hospitals imposing their will, as it were, on women, forcing inductions, not doing VBACs, but really not giving women much much say in their birth experience, really not allowing women to have any sort of say in what goes on, and then the fact that there are states where nurse midwives aren't allowed, or there's definitely states where direct entry midwives are illegal. So there's not options everywhere. And because of that, that's where this free birth movement has started. Unfortunately, I think that there's a lot of things with obstetrics that that women can get themselves into trouble without proper care. And I think that care can come from any number of sources. It can come from an obstetrician, a family practice doctor, a nurse midwife, or a direct entry midwife. All provide good care. But I think women need to have somebody who's there to watch over their best interest.
Just to play a little bit of a devil's advocate, though, here, like, isn't it also quite likely that since we are human animals and animals all deliver pretty much by themselves in nature, doesn't it stand to reason that most women should be able to do a free birth without complications in their homes?
Well, you would think so, but, I mean, if you talk about mammals and how to deliver, we've got an obstetrician that works in our hospital that also raises animals and had several animals at the Alaska State Fair last year. And I remember her walking in and saying, you know, well, we lost the 8th one. It just wasn't going to make it, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's a normal part of delivery with those animals. You know, some make it, some don't. The mom just keeps right on going. if we're going to say that and compare them to the rest of the mammal species, we have to be willing to accept the fact that some babies just won't make it. And unfortunately, in our society, I don't think that most moms are that willing to just accept the fact that that's part of nature.
Mm-hmm. Either of you ladies, Lisa Weston or Jessica Sawyer, have any comments about this practice of free birthing?
Well, I agree fully that, yes, most women can birth on their own without a lot of interventions. But the risk is that the infant mortality rate would be much higher, and the maternal mortality rate would be much higher as well. I really don't think it's the safest thing unless they're really totally willing to accept that they could lose their baby. And the chances are much higher than if you are in a setting where you have help available.
Mm-hmm.
In the uncommon instance of shoulder dystocia, mm-hmm. you have minutes.
Right.
7-8 minutes in order to relieve that shoulder being stuck before you talk about significant brain damage to babies. Mm. Without some trained attendance, the likelihood of that baby having a problem would be significantly higher.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I did have a comment about that as well. I first want to say that I have a real healthy respect for women's intuition, and I have seen enough times where just mom will have a hunch that she needs to be in the hospital, or she needs to be in this position or that position, or she needs to be at home, whatever. But I think that moms who are really in touch with their bodies will make wise decisions concerning their care. Having said that, I would not recommend to anyone to have an unassisted birth, just because in those few instances when risks do come up, oftentimes there's a very easy, small intervention that can be done that makes a huge difference in, you know, if somebody is bleeding too much, they just need, you know, a small shot of Pitocin and a midwife to keep their uterus tight for a few minutes to stop that bleeding, or, you know, situation like the shoulder dystocia. There are several situations where a trained attendant can do a very minimal amount of intervention, something super easy and might not even seem like intervention, but it can change the course of a labor or of a birth. And like you had said, most babies will be born just fine. That nature is designed very well, and it's very safe process. But the times that something does go wrong or starts to go wrong, or there are lots of times that we can even make it easier, even if the outcome would be okay, it could be easier and it could be simplified by a trained attendant, you know, making a very small suggestion or intervention. So I think that while I understand the motivation of women to want to be real independent, when you're in labor, it's not a time that you can really be your own advocate. At that time, you need someone that you can trust who will be advocating for you and watching out for your best interests, because you'll be, you know, having all you can do just to deal with your immediate situation. And so if some complication does arise at that point, you're not in a state where you will be able to have good decision-making skills.
Well, we have time enough for one last question. I'm wondering, where should a woman who is newly pregnant and this is her first child, and there's, Dr. Elrod, you mentioned that, you know, being educated about your choices and so forth is of utmost importance. You know, where does that woman start? What should her first step be? How can she find the information about her community and the resources that she needs to get on the path to being where she wants to be on delivery day?
Well, I think, especially in Alaska, I think word of mouth is huge. You can talk to girlfriends and sisters and family members that have had positive experiences. I know with work with local midwives, you know, the word of mouth amongst the midwifery community is huge. There are plenty of places on the internet where you can look up information about options, but I really think that word of mouth is important. And then secondly, meet and talk to people. Talk to the providers. Make an appointment, sit down, and say, what do you expect out of your pregnant women? Do you have childbirth education? Are you passionate about natural childbirth? Are you passionate about VBACs, if that's the case? And really get a sense for what that provider, be it a doctor, a nurse, a midwife, has to say and make sure that they're a good fit for you. I really think that, at least in my practice, I think that getting to know patients and getting to know, have them get to know me and know what I stand for is most important. But it all comes from word of mouth.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's discussion. I'd like to thank each of you for being a part of Kids These Days today. Dr. D. Glenn Elrod joined us by phone from Chicago. He is a MATSU OBGYN, and Jessica Sawyer is a certified direct entry midwife and a certified professional midwife, and she works at MATSU Midwifery, also in Wasilla.
Yep.
And Lisa Weston is a certified nurse midwife who is employed by South Central Foundation and works at the Alaska Native Medical Center. Thanks to each of you for being here today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you're paying attention, today's messages to new moms include breast milk is best and advice for how to tell the difference between the baby blues and full-blown postpartum depression. But it's a challenge sometimes for healthcare providers to get messages like these and other health-related information to at-risk mothers-to-be. Dr. Mark Erickson, an Anchorage psychiatrist, has some ideas about how wraparound support for pregnant women and new mothers who are considered at risk can help reduce child maltreatment. I recently sat down with Dr. Erickson and asked him to explain. Dr. Erickson, you have many passions, it seems like, but some of those passions are related to ideas you have around birth and the experience before birth and during birth and then directly after birth. Could you tell me a little bit about some of those ideas you're working on at South Central?
The birth experience has quite a powerful effect on bonding. We know from a variety of different studies. And a very recent paper came out just last year, which showed that the duration of breastfeeding, whether it lasted for 4 months or longer, had really a pretty profound effect on the quality of the mother-infant bond and actually a reduction of the risk for child maltreatment. This study came out of Australia. You can imagine all sorts of confounding variables that mothers who breastfed longer wanted the child more. They weren't using drugs and so forth. So they controlled for everything they could imagine. They actually controlled for 18 different variables and still found a significant reduction in maltreatment among mothers who breastfed longer. So this was a fascinating finding, and we asked ourselves what factors increase the duration of breastfeeding. And to my surprise, in reviewing the literature, they tend to cluster around the quality of the birth experience, the presence of a doula at birth, the availability of lactation consultants, establishment is what is known as a baby-friendly hospital, which is the United Nations program that really increases the quality of the birth experience. These are factors which seem to increase the duration of breastfeeding, and based on this Australian study I just mentioned, could conceivably substantially prevent child maltreatment. I guess one other piece I'd like to add is that we now know that breastfeeding has very substantial central nervous system effects on the mother. When the mother breastfeeds, within her brain, hormones like oxytocin, which is a bonding hormone, and prolactin, which is a hormone related to maternal care, are released. In addition to this, the neurotransmitter dopamine is released, and dopamine is a pleasure neurotransmitter. So when a woman breastfeeds, it's almost as though this elixir, this of maternal bonding and care, is released into her brain. And this makes sense of these findings, that simply increasing the duration of breastfeeding may actually prevent child abuse and neglect. A remarkable historical study that was of a hospital in Paris in the 1800s known as La Maternité. This study was done by an academician at the University of Arizona a few years ago. But she went back and she looked at the birth records in this hospital. And prior to 1837, almost two-thirds of the infants born in this hospital were abandoned to a foundling home that was literally across the street.
Two-thirds?
Two-thirds, yeah. It was astonishing. Gosh. And at that time, being abandoned to a foundling home was almost a death sentence. Most of these infants would have died. So what the hospital did was simply ask mothers to stay and nurse. And they found that by doing this, there was a really quite substantial reduction in abandonment. Very, very simple intervention. And over the ensuing decades, the policies changed a bit, but basically what it showed is that if you take at-risk women and you provide them with a safe, supportive respite or haven, if you will, for at least a few days postpartum, that this has a quite substantial effect on reducing abandonment.
So I can't help but wonder a little bit about sort of flipping this idea on its head and saying, so if an at-risk mother or a mother who's not at risk has a negative birth experience and is not encouraged or given support to breastfeed, does that mean that they're sort of more likely negative consequences? Is that some experience that's very difficult for a mother to overcome if it happens?
That's a great question. There's not a lot of research in that area pertaining to your question, but what exists certainly is suggestive. In experimental studies with animals, what they've shown is that if they can induce higher levels of oxytocin in animals that seem to be having trouble bonding with their newborn, that this in and of itself will substantially improve bonding and maternal care. It's not difficult to imagine how that could be done in hospitals. Simple assistance from a doula, someone who's experienced in the bonding process, might help a mother who appeared to be doing well initially and then seemed to have gotten off track to get back on track. I want to add one other piece here. There's increasing interest in biological changes that fathers experience, both during the pregnancy and birth and postpartum of their partner. And there's very little work in this area, but the work that has come out suggests that fathers, particularly if they're involved, undergo hormonal changes to a lesser degree, but similar in nature, that women undergo.
Really?
There's data that suggests that paternal engagement increases prolactin in fathers, and also there's two studies that just came out this year showing changes in oxytocin in fathers. And it's not difficult to imagine that these hormonal changes are important in paternal engagement. And
so this goes beyond like the husband or the father of the child to be gaining 10 pounds during his partner's pregnancy. It goes beyond that, or is that what we're talking about?
That's part of it. I mean, what you're describing are known as Couvaud symptoms, which are the father has some of the same sort of bodily changes that his pregnant partner might have. And there's this is a fascinating area. I'm sure there'll be a lot more work coming out because it suggests that there are things that might be done to improve the engagement of fathers in the care of offspring. With what we're learning about hormonal changes in men, and you think about the fact that these hormonal changes are occurring, the father is not pregnant. There's not an internal signal that this baby's coming. So there's something that's happening, and the thinking here is that that there's some signal either coming from the mother at probably a very fundamental sort of pheromonal level, or possibly even the fetus that is inducing these changes in males as they become fathers. One of the foremost researchers in this area is a woman named Toni Ziegler at the University of Wisconsin. And her research actually suggests that there's signals coming from, and this is in non-human primate work, but it's actually coming from the fetus,
wow.
which is quite remarkable to think of, and that this is inducing these changes in the father, that so that when the birth comes, the father is more inclined to care for the offspring.
At your position at South Central Foundation, given what you know and what your passions are, what are some of your ideas for how the birth experience and then some of these early years could be improved or made better for the clients and the patients that come to your organization?
Yes. What we have done over the last 2 years in particular is to begin a major rethink of what we do basically from preconception to age five. And we are at different stages of this rethinking process. We know, this is shifting just a little bit, but we know that home visitation programs, where nurses go into the homes of young families, that these programs can be enormously helpful in terms of bonding and good care and so forth. And so we looked at our home visitation program, which is called Natoxivik, which actually is quite a good program, but we carefully looked at it and we compared it to this broad evidence base that exists. And we could see that we were really understaffed and that we probably should follow these families longer than we do. Other pieces we're looking at improving the birth experience in various ways. This is something that we're not quite as far along as home visitation, but there are these different pieces that we hope to bring together. And the initiative is called New Generations, and the idea is to try to create a very seamless program of care that is focused on basically preconception to age five, as I mentioned.
Well, Dr. Mark Erickson, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to Kids These Days today.
My pleasure.
It's been great to have you.
Thanks.
That's it for Kids These Days today. Thanks again to our in-studio and phone-in guests. You can find this program right now on our website. Check it out at www.kidsthesedays.org. You can register and comment on this program, add your own story, and search our archives for other topics that might interest you. From our homepage, you can link to us through social media, get KTD updates through Facebook and Twitter. You can like us and retweet us anytime, anywhere, and please do. Today's program was produced by Sarah Gonzalez. Jessica Cochran reported from Anchorage. Our Kids These Days theme music was performed and composed by Mind Over Matthew. Link to more of his music from our website as well. Once again, Happy New Year from all of us at Kids These Days. I'd like to thank our program partners for the first time in 2011 today. What you hear on Kids These Days is made possible through the collaborative work of the Content Producers Guild, KSKA-FM, KRUA-FM, and the University of Alaska Anchorage Journalism and Public Communications Department. And our funding comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. I'm Shanna Sheehy. We'll see you here again next week.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.